the shiny tops of my Mary Janes. "My tutor died," I said, "unexpectedly. My parents thought I should come be with my uncle in the States for a change of scenery. And besides, I didn't apply to conservatory yet. I thought I'd perhaps take a gap year."
"Her tutor's loss has been quite the blow. They'd worked together for a long time."
Leander stole a look at me.
"She's going to hate me for this, but..."
I colored. "No, don't. You promised you wouldn't."
"You should play for him."
He reached into his bag and pulled out my violin case. "Uncle," I protested.
"No, show him what you're made of. Show him why you're a good fit for this school."
Leander turned to the counselor.
"That's the idea, right? She'll be able to pursue professional opportunities, and she'll have the finest instruction. Play for him."
Hartwell sat back in his leather chair.
"I'm no judge. She'd have to play for the music faculty at auditions."
Then the corners of his mouth turned up indulgently.
"Is she any good?"
I drew my instrument up to me like the living thing it was. It hadn't been in my hands now for so long, an extravagance and a danger, lugging it around with me, a hobby of mine that I couldn't hide. I could almost feel it breathing there under my fingers.
"That's a Stradivarius."
Hartwell's eyes glittered.
"Interesting."
I put it under my chin, arranged my fingering. I always thought a little about the sky when I held my violin, a bird wheeling, the sun, that sort of thing. It was difficult to explain. A very, very cursory Google search had found that Michael Hartwell was a significant donor to both the Metropolitan Opera and the New York Philharmonic, hence the violin. Leander gave me a moment to settle. Then he said,
"Mr. Hartwell, I think she'll make you weep. Play him an original, Charlotte."
Had my eyes not already been closed, I would have startled like a hare. This hadn't been in the design at all, which already skewed far closer to the truth than I wanted it to be. I had proposed that Leander play my father. We'd be Americans recently returned from abroad. We would say that I wrote songs on my guitar about our quaint life in Surrey and how I missed it so. I would ask Hartwell to introduce me to his daughter, the songwriter. I would be a fan. He would be flattered, he would feel appreciated, perhaps be more willing to talk. Leander had refused. "Bring your violin, be my niece, let me take the lead." I never let anyone else take the lead, not when I was involved. I never deviated from the plan unless I had to, and had to had a very narrow definition. I could comfortably bluff my way through having a gun put to my head. But I didn't trust my instincts today, not with all that fear still rattling around in my chest. I'd taken a step back. Was this willingness to give up the lead maturity or hesitation? I didn't know. It had been one thing with D.I. Green, who could give me directions but wasn't there to see me follow or not follow them. This was something else. And now Leander was calling me Charlotte when the name on my form read Harriet Heloise Simpson, and he was telling me to play a composition that I hadn't, well, composed. Had Hartwell noticed the name? He must have. I couldn't risk opening my eyes to check. Whatever my uncle was playing at... But more than a moment had passed now, long enough for an 18-year-old girl to believably compose herself, but anything longer, and... I began to play, pulling from a folk tune I remembered from a village concert as a child. My parents had never taken us. There wasn't much art in their blood, but I had been 8 and obsessed with my fiddle, and Milo had been home for the summer, and when our housekeeper told us about the festival, he'd seen the longing in my face.
"You're indulging her?"
my father had asked. Not judging, not surprised. Milo shrugged.
"She wants to hear the band," he said,
the only time I could remember him pushing back against my father, and he hoisted me onto his skinny shoulders and took me into town. We didn't have much down there. A Tesco, a wine bar, a few nebulously purposed shops that sold gifts, the usual lineup for a tourist haunt by the sea. But that night, we had a gazebo on the village green and a quartet playing folk airs, and my brother kept me on his shoulders as we watched. People weren't used to us being out, as a family. We Holmeses were the vampires up the hill. but I clapped my hands along to the music, and my brother bounced me in time to the beat, and soon an elderly gentleman approached and asked me if I wanted to dance with him. Milo heaved me down and watched, bemused, as I was spun and spun and spun in my dress, and then sat dizzy onto the ground. "Did you like that?" he said when it was over. The old man had bought me a taffy apple at the stand, and I held it out on the walk back to our land, too afraid to eat it. "Yes," I remember saying. "I liked how sad it was." Because the day had ended. There would be no more days just like it. If I ate the apple, it too would be gone, and soon enough Milo would be back at the school that was changing him. My brother didn't press me to explain. I took that day and laid it under this one. I spun those two parallel moments into a song and then played it, and I played for some time. When I opened my eyes, Michael Hartwell was weeping.
"Charlotte," he said, and the hair on my neck stood up. "That was beautiful. I'm so sorry."
I set down my violin on my lap. Then I said, "You know who I am then?"
Hartwell said, "I've been shown photos of you, yes. But not me,"
Leander said, standing.
"No, only the girl, Charlotte."
My uncle put himself more fully between me and Michael Hartwell.
"You're here," he said, as Hartwell wiped his eyes. "But you did your residency at Washington Mercy in psychology. Is that right?"
Hartwell, I noticed, was shaking. Perhaps it was an aftershock from his tears.
"Yes. What does Moriarty have on you?"
"Nothing,"
Hartwell said.
"Nothing."
I cleared my throat. "Then what is he offering you? He's using your passport to get into the country. Why isn't he just using a dead man's identity?" I wanted to hear what his answer would be. Hartwell looked at me with red-rimmed eyes. I didn't think this show of emotion was for my music. I think the music had reminded him of something. Someone. His daughter, by the way his eyes kept straying to the photo on his desk of her in a blue dress holding her guitar. The frame said, "My musical girl."
"It's a deal," he said slowly. I have connections. I know people. At Washington Mercy, at... I know people, okay? He wants me to use those connections to arrange something for him, and if I don't, he's going to... I can't talk to you about this. I have children. I have a family to protect."
A posh hospital in D.C., a wilderness rehab in Connecticut, a prep school in New York. Hartwell turned to Leander.
"If you're really her uncle, you'll get her far away from this, as quickly as you can, okay? Pack your bags, get on a flight, go somewhere inaccessible. I don't even know if this office is bugged."
Leander took a step forward, his finely made hands in his pockets.
"When's the last time you swept it?"
"Swept it?"
Hartwell stared at him.
"I'm a psychologist. Mr. Holmes, I'm not like you, any of you. I don't know how to sweep an office for bugs."
A helicopter buzzed the roof. The sound came on like a swarm of bees. "Is there a helipad nearby?" I asked, tracking it.
"It's not... he isn't here,"
he managed to say.
"Not yet. So go. Leave town. And if you don't, I can't be held responsible for what happens."
There was nothing else to be said. We bundled up our things quickly and ran outside, my violin case banging clumsily against my leg. It was wretched outside, the rain turned to sleet, and we held on to each other, pulling ourselves up the block step by sleety step. "You called me Charlotte," I said to him at the corner, as we waited for the light to change. "You outed us. Why?"
"What are the markers of a good man?"
he asked me. "I'm sorry?"
"The markers," he said, "of a good man. How can you tell if a man is someone you can trust?"
"I don't," I said. "I don't trust... well, I trust you." I thought, strangely, that Leander was going to laugh, and that it was a laugh that I didn't want to see. His hair was slicked back off his face, and he was hatless, and the sleet was beading on him like pearls. His greatcoat was beautifully tailored, his boots were a soft brown and quietly handsome, and he had a look on his face so wolf-like he would have driven any sheep back to pasture. He could be terrifying. I realized it now. As I watched him, Leander carefully put his expression away, as though he were folding it up like a jacket. The light changed. He was benign again, a benevolent gentleman, a lamb.
"You'll learn," he said. "But not yet. I don't want you to trust anyone again until this is over."
"Even you?" He looked at me.
"Perhaps," he said.
I put my hand in the crook of his arm and said nothing. Someone was close behind us, slipping on the snow to overtake us, and I took a breath, and Leander steeled his shoulders. And then he was passing us, an older man with a cane who wished us a good afternoon and disappeared into the fading light. Even now, Lucy and Moriarty could be playing back our conversation with Michael Hartwell. New York was a trap, I thought, and we'd walked right into it. Leander was nodding as though he could hear my thoughts.
"When we get home, you're packing. We're leaving. Tonight."
17. Jamie. The rugby players I knew were masters at a certain kind of intimidation. It had everything to do with their bodies, drawing their shoulders back to call attention to their size, or yelling and hollering with their friends until the veins in their neck stood out, licking a guy's forehead to make him squeal like a girl, pissing in a guy's shoes to see if you could make him step in them and scream like a girl, coughing up shit from their lungs and spitting it, breathing heavy in each other's faces, then howling, pushing each other over on the field between plays, all to see if their macho-macho-ness would break someone down into what they saw as feminine weakness. Being a girl was their worst fear, and they chalked up all kinds of behavior to girliness, things that didn't make sense. I don't know why they were so specifically afraid of it. From what I could tell, most of them liked girls, had them for friends, wanted so badly to date them or screw them that it was all they could talk about after practice. But when we were all in a pack together, practicing a game where we tackled each other into the ground like beasts, there were the guys who liked the game, and then there were those who lusted for it, the hard takedown, the feeling of pushing someone else down into the mud. It bubbled up outside of practice in physical ways. Not all my teammates were like that. Barely half, if I had to count, but it was more than enough for me. I'd learned to go stoic and invisible when this kind of shit started so that I didn't become its target. It was a strategy Kittredge took, too. "Not today." I turned in my chair. "You have things to say to me? Say them." He licked his lips. "You're trying to blame this on me," he said. "Marta told me. She told me everything." "Blame what on you, exactly? What are you being blamed for?" All I did was berate people anymore. I might as well be my ex-best friend. "I don't see you being threatened with suspension, or anyone pointing their finger at you for $1,000 goddamn. So what? Because Elizabeth and I asked questions about who Anna talked to last night, I'm suddenly putting your ass to the fire? I don't think so." Kittredge shook his head. "I didn't take her money," he said. "Her alleged money." "Stop saying that," he interrupted. I had taken this strategy from Holmes, and it rarely failed. People could always be provoked to correct you. "You act like you know what happened, but you don't. I saw it. She had this fat wad of bills in her pocket. She took it out to show me." "She did? Why?" He looked around carefully, but the library stacks were empty except for us. "Because she said someone gave it to her. She was laughing, like in disbelief. It's not like she needed the money," she said, "but she was giddy about it. I couldn't tell if it was the MDMA. I don't do that shit, so I don't know." "I don't either." "Listen," he spread his hand on the table, then balled it up. "If I were you, I'd be talking to Beckett Lexington. He sold her those pills. Maybe he was giving her a cash advance on some sales she was going to do for him. He does that sometimes. Randall was telling me." It was a better working theory than anything I had. My estimation of Kittredge went up a notch. "I will," I said. Kittredge stood. "We didn't talk about this, okay?" "You don't want Anna to find out," I said. "No," he eyed me cautiously. "But I also don't want someone suspended for shit they didn't do. Beckett works at the school radio station. Start there." He stuck out his hand. I clasped it, and just like that, we weren't animals anymore. "Let's just get out of Sharingford before it eats us alive," Kittredge said. But Beckett Lexington wasn't easy to find. I checked the radio station, a pokey little warren in the basement of Weaver Hall, and found the system on autoplay, records scattered across the floor. The cafeteria wasn't open for another hour, so I couldn't corner him at dinner. Finally, I looked up his room in the online directory. Apparently, he lived on the first floor of my dorm. But I hesitated at the steps up to Michener. Mrs. Dunham would be at the front desk, and she would have heard about my forced leave of absence. I wasn't sure I wanted to risk being thrown off campus, especially by someone I respected. My phone buzzed. "Your mother's getting in tonight," my dad had texted. "What time do you want me to pick you up?" "Can I let you know?" I wrote back. I was standing in the shadows, debating, when Mrs. Dunham came to the door. "It's freezing," she said, ushering me in. "Come on, I'll put the kettle on for you. Isn't that how you say it? Put the kettle on."
"Are you sure?" I asked.
She waved a hand.
"I won't tell the administration if you won't," she said, walking back up to her desk. "I'm just icing some cookies I brought from home. Do you want to help?"
There were worse things to do on a stakeout. I dragged a chair over from the lobby. Mrs. Dunham's desk was a riot of cheerful uselessness. Her knitting was in a basket, full of the bright scarves she made to send off to her daughter at school, and a series of Dala horses she'd brought back from Sweden, red and blue in a line that she said were for luck. She kept her coffee mug on an ever-rotating stack of poetry books, Mary Oliver and Frank O'Hara and Terence Hayes, and beside that a tablet that was always streaming something mindless, a buddy cop show or a British baking program. All of her projects could be abandoned at a moment's notice if she needed to run off to put out some small fire in the dorm. Today, she had sugar cookies in a giant plastic container and a number of smaller ones full of red and blue and green frosting. She handed me a knife, then started back up her baking show. I watched the door and tried very hard not to eat every cookie I iced. Guys came in and out on their way back from practice or the library or the union, and I steeled myself against the looks I'd get if the news about Anna's money and my leave of absence had spread. But they didn't. A few said hi or asked if I was sick, since I hadn't been in class, and I told them, yes, very sick, not contagious, no, I'll see you guys next week. When things were going wrong, it was so easy to imagine that everyone knew, that everyone was talking about it. But nobody cared nearly as much about your life as you did. We finally came to the bottom layer of cookies just as the 4:30 lull hit, the moment before everyone came down to go to dinner. No sign of Beckett Lexington yet. I looked again at Mrs. Dunham's desk, but this time my eyes drifted down to the place she kept the master key. "Something strange happened to me the other day," I said.
"Oh?"
she asked, only half listening. A girl on the baking show had burnt her English muffins. "Yeah," I said. "Someone got into my room and sprayed a can of soda everywhere." Mrs. Dunham turned to me, shocked. It looked genuine.
"That's terrible, Jamie. Are your things okay?"
"Not really. But, you know, I lock my door. I was just wondering if anyone came through and asked for the master key yesterday afternoon." I was starting to feel a little sick from everything I'd eaten. Frowning, Mrs. Dunham pulled out the maintenance record.
"A carpenter at 7 a.m. fixing a broken window sash."
"Too early."
"And, of course, Elizabeth when she came up to find you after dinner."
She glanced at me.
"Do you want me to stop doing that? I do know that you like to keep your door locked even when you're in there, love, but she's your girlfriend."
"It's fine," I told her. "I appreciate it."
"You two have been through enough. I like to make your lives easier in little ways if I can," Mrs. Dunham said stoutly.
She returned to her record.
"Otherwise, I gave it to a student at Bedcheck when he locked himself out. Do you want his name?"
"No." I was starting to feel really nauseous, actually, enough that I was starting to sweat. "No, that's too late. It's okay." I pushed the cookies back toward her. "Thanks for looking."
"You know," she said, "you actually don't look very well. Do you want to go to the infirmary?"
I reacted to the word infirmary the way you would to being hit in the face.
Oh, you know Nurse Bryony doesn't work there anymore. It's fine to go if you're ill. You'd be safe.
I'm fine, I said, gasping a little. PTSD, Lena had said. Was it true? I hardly even knew what that was.
Jamie,
she said, reaching out to touch my forehead. Unthinking, I jerked away. Because the week I was having wouldn't allow for anything else, Beckett Lexington chose that moment to walk in the front door.
"Watson," he said, stomping his snow boots on the mat.
"You look awful, man." I couldn't deal with it right now. "I feel awful," I said. "Can you hold on a second? I think Elizabeth said she wanted to talk to you." He brushed his asymmetrical hair out of his face.
"Yeah," he said. "That's cool. Hey, can I have one of those?"
"Of course," Mrs. Dunham said, holding the container out. I hunched over my phone, trying very hard not to look at Beckett stuffing a red and green cookie into his mouth. "SOS," I texted Elizabeth. "Beckett Lexington at Michener. Kittredge thinks he gave Anna the money, having an incident like an asshole."
"You're not an asshole. There in five,"
she wrote back almost immediately. I wasn't sure what information she could get out of him, especially if she went after him with a hatchet like she had the girls at lunch, but I was in no state to try to interrogate someone. All I could really do was call my father.
"Dad," I said as soon as he picked up, "you need to come get me. Like, now." "I'm just in town running errands," he said. "I'll be there in a minute."
I waited for him outside on the steps, breathing in and out, slowly, trying not to immediately assume that I'd been infected with a nanovirus. Ever since the run-in with Bryony Downs, where she'd stuck me with an infected spring, I could work myself up into a panic any time I felt ill. Panic or fear, or was it trauma? Or maybe Mrs. Dunham was poisoning me. No, the cold air felt good on my face. I shut my eyes for a second, swaying, and when I opened them, Elizabeth was staring at me.
"You okay?"
I gestured inside to Beckett scrolling through his phone, cookie in hand.
"Talk to him?" I asked.
Unexpectedly, she grinned.
"You have frosting on your face," she said. "Blue frosting. You look like a snowman. Did you eat cookies for dinner?"
I hadn't eaten lunch, I remembered. We'd left the bistro without me ordering anything. In fact, I hadn't eaten anything all day. The thought made the nausea lessen a little. "It's just panic," I told myself again.
"Jamie,"
she said, starting up the steps toward me.
"I'm okay," I said.
She had a knit hat on, and the color matched her eyes. In that moment, I was so grateful that I could cry.
"Thank you for everything you're doing to help. You don't need to be doing it."
She took off a glove, then reached out and with a finger took a bit of icing off my lips.
"Well," she said softly, "of course I'm helping."
My father's sedan pulled up to the curb.
"That's my cue," I said.
"I'll go talk to Lexington, find out what he knows. Will you call me later?"
"Yeah," I said, and on impulse I kissed her cheek. "Talk to you tonight."
I popped the trunk of his car and made room for my backpack amidst a cluster of grocery bags. There were fancy things spilling out of them. Goat cheese, a few bottles of wine, some pickled Italian things I didn't recognize. I swallowed down my nausea and hopped into the front seat.
"You're excited to see Mum, I take it," I said. "Big dinner plans?"
My father shrugged.
"Just trying to be a good host?"
The car was warm, too warm, and I cracked the window as he pulled out of the school gates.
"Sorry," I said. "I'm feeling kind of gross."
He gave me a look.
"Apparently not that gross. How's Elizabeth? Are you two back on?"
"No, maybe. No, no, we're not." I knew it wasn't a good answer. I thought about saying something like, "I can only solve one mystery at a time," and then cringed. What was it that Elizabeth had said? Being aware of it didn't excuse your crappy behavior. My father didn't say anything else until we'd made it out of Sherringford Town and into the cold, white fields beyond.
It isn't nice to leave people in the dark, he said finally, with an odd vehemence. I looked at him.
Am I leaving you in the dark about something?
Elizabeth, he said, gripping the wheel.
That poor girl. She has expectations, you know, and I don't want you jerking her around. It's not very nice. I don't like to see that kind of behavior in you.
I didn't like it in me either, but it was sort of beside the point. My father never came down on me like this for anything.
Are you all right? Is everything okay with Abby?
You don't need to get yourself involved in that.
Okay, I said, unsettled. I'd groused a lot over the years about my father's relentless good humor, but I was discovering I didn't know what to do when it wasn't there.
The night got darker, street lights winking out as we drove further into the countryside. It wasn't proper farmland, with farms and turbines and hay for miles and miles. Instead, the road wandered through little towns, none of them any bigger than a gas station and a couple of bars, surrounded by ancient farmhouses. During the day, it was unremarkable, but at night, with the snow turning into sleet, those old houses were strange and sad.
Then again, my father said out of nowhere, it isn't fair for her to expect things from you that you can't give her. Has she even said anything to you about it?
I blinked.
Yes? Well, that's good. Good. Good for her. That's better than just wanting things and never saying anything about it and hanging around feeling tortured instead of communicating your feelings like an actual adult.
We were definitely not talking about Elizabeth. Dad, I swallowed, then said, is everything okay with Leander? He almost swerved off the road.
What are you talking about?
I think you know what I'm talking about, I said, not unkindly. More silence, more farmhouses, standing like sentinels in the dark. My father pounded his hand against the wheel once, twice, three times.
Your stepmother doesn't like Leander hanging around so much, looking at her like, she says, and I quote, like he's just waiting for James to realize how much more he likes him than me.
He's been at the house a lot, I take it.
He's renting a place down the road, my father said. I haven't gotten to see him this much in 10 years. We'll usually put together a few weekends in the summer, run around Edinburgh like we used to, tidy up the ends of some case he's solving. But you know, it was never enough. It was the best when he lived so close to us in London. But that, of course, made your mother furious. I shouldn't be telling you this.
Probably not, I said.
Abby is different, you know, more adventurous. Oh, we have a lot of fun.
He nodded as if talking himself into something.
She thinks he's in love with me.
There it was. Is he? I asked.
No,
he sounded almost relieved that the conversation had made its way here, as though this had been the end point all along.
No, he's not. Just because he's gay doesn't mean he's in love with his straight best friend. I hate when people insinuate that. You know, that's insulting to both of us. And anyway, he's brilliant, you know. Leander is the life of every room, and he's obviously a good-looking man. He could have anyone he wanted. He's not just hanging around pining after me. Of all people, that would be absurd. That would be...
He trailed off. It would be really sad for him, I said, looking down at my hands.
Oh, God, my father said.
The sleet was coming down harder. Little dots and dashes of hail were bouncing off of the windshield.
Yeah, I paused.
He's your favorite person?
Mechanically, he put on the wipers.
I'm not attracted to men.
He's not an exception to that.
But
he's my favorite person.
He was talking almost as if to himself.
Don't you wish sometimes that who you spent your life with was determined just by that? Wouldn't that make it less complicated?
I was 17 years old. I was dating or not dating another girl who was right now questioning the campus dealer about a crime I hadn't committed, and I was in love with my best friend, who I hadn't seen for a year, but who lived on in my day-to-day like a splinter in my goddamn heart. I thought about the rest of my life a lot more than I'd like to admit.
I don't think that makes it less complicated, I said. Our house came into view. Despite the weather, the garage was open and lit up, and inside it, figures were hauling in suitcases from a rental car.
Your mother's here,
my father said happily as we pulled up into the drive. He was doing that adult thing that I hated, where he pretended an uncomfortable conversation hadn't happened.
Go in through the front, will you, and make sure the cat hasn't gotten out, and see if your stepmother needs help.
I grabbed my backpack and a few of the grocery bags, trying not to look inside them. My stomach still wanted to pretend that food didn't exist, and fought my way through the sleet through the front door. Abby wasn't anywhere to be seen. Neither was the cat. I was checking inside the pantry, looking for it, when my phone rang. It was a number I didn't recognize. Hello?
Jamie, it's me.
Shelby? I said, moving around some bags of potatoes. No cat. Where are you? Aren't you here? Are you okay?
Are you alone?
Her voice was urgent, ragged. I grabbed the pantry door and shut it.
I am now. What's wrong?
Jamie, everything is seriously so messed up. I don't even know where to begin, and I think I only have a minute.
My heart was racing.
What's happening, Shell?
That school in Connecticut? It's not a school, Jamie. It's like some kind of rehab, and I have no idea why I'm here, but I'm here. I'm in the infirmary because I fainted, I guess, when I figured out what was going on, and I'm using the phone here because they took mine. But the doctor might be back, and Jamie, you have to do something. You have to come get me.
Rehab? I couldn't quite believe what I was hearing.
What was their justification? What the hell is going on? It was Mum. I don't even understand it. She's super furious about the stuff going down with you still, which is weird, first of all, because usually she, like, rages but then gets over it. And then she was going through my things and she found a bottle of vodka in my drawer, but it wasn't mine, I swear. I'd never seen it before.
I believe you.
And Ted tried to talk her down, and then... Footsteps. I hear footsteps. Wait.
I stood there in the dark pantry, clutching the phone to my face, listening to my sister's frightened breathing. I'd never felt so helpless in my life.
They're gone, she whispered. I don't know when they're coming back, but the school... I can't. It's like a wilderness camp, and there are horses, but it's like survivalist. They put you in the woods for days. There's no school at all. And Mum insisted. And she and Ted got married.
What?
It was supposed to be a surprise.
Shelby had been talking so quickly, I could only half understand her.
In the middle of the day yesterday, in London at the courthouse. So, like, meet your new stepdad?
Are you serious? A rustle. A man's voice.
No, no,
she was saying, and then the line went dead. The nausea hit me again, full force, this vertiginous feeling like I was crashing, and I was sure now that all of it was panic. I made myself breathe. Be logical, I thought. Be a grown-up. Shelby could be lying about the vodka. It could have been hers. The school could just be more severe than she was used to. It could be homesickness. Ted could be a nice guy. Breathe. From the garage, I heard my father saying a hearty congratulations. Laughter. The garage door groaning to a close. They staggered in through the door then, laughing. My mum with her hand on my father's arm, chatting excitedly. My new stepdad hauling a pair of bags behind them.
Jamie,
my mother said when she saw me, rushing forward.
I swear you've gotten taller. Hello, sweetheart.
She grabbed me by the shoulders. She was never this effusive.
It's so good to see you.
Hey, I said, forcing myself to sound friendly. Where's Shelby? Thought she was coming.
Loved her school, Ted said behind my dad. Just loved it. Wanted to start right away.
He had a wonderful speaking voice, a round tenor with a Welsh accent.
She did,
my mum said, and turned back to me.
Just loved it. And we have news.
Crazy, not so fast, Ted said. I haven't even met the boy yet.
Hi, I said, stepping forward to shake Ted's hand. I was going to rewrite this conversation. Take control. I figure out exactly what was going on. I'm Jamie. It's nice to finally meet you. He took it, scowling a little. Ted was tall, broad-shouldered, surprisingly bald. Maybe my sister had mentioned that to me before. But he didn't have eyebrows, either. It looked almost as though he'd shaved them, and his eyes beneath were small and shrewd. He looked like someone, I thought, my pulse beginning to speed up. Who did he look like?
Jamie, he said. Hi, Ted Polnitz.
His given name is Tracy, my mother said, coming up beside him, smiling.
She'd had her hair done, her makeup. She was wearing a necklace that belonged to my grandmother, pearls on a long string. She looked beautiful.
Tracy, isn't that cute? But he prefers his middle name, Theodore, more serious. And we have plans for tonight. A reception.
A wedding reception, my father said, bemused. We're doing a dinner thing in New York tonight. I was hardly paying attention.
You remind me of someone, I said to Ted, slowly.
He grinned at me.
I get that a lot.
Jamie? My mother asked. Are you okay?
When he smiled, my new stepfather looked just like August, and Philippa, and Hadrian. I'm fine, I said to Lucien Moriarty.
Really? It's just so good to finally meet you.
18. Charlotte. Back at the flat, I was throwing things into my suitcase, not bothering to fold them. I could hear Leander on the phone pleading with someone. Tonight, he was saying. It can't wait. And had I wanted to, I could have gone to the door to listen. It didn't matter now what he was saying, not really.
We'll regroup from a distance, he'd told me. We don't have the time to bag him when he arrives, and God knows what he plans on doing when he gets here. We'll find some high ground, girl. Pack your bags.
There was a kind of relief in it, the giving up. We would plan, and in the meantime, Leander would let me live with him. He hadn't offered, not as such, but for the rest of the walk home, he'd been listing places we could go. As the eldest of his siblings, my father had inherited our house in Sussex. My aunt Araminta had been formally given the cottage and apiary where she'd taken to spending her days, my uncle Julian our flat in London, and presumably leave to never talk to the rest of us again, a smart decision. My uncle Leander had been too peripatetic to be given land, the will had read. He'd been granted my grandfather's money instead, our intelligently invested takings from the life rights of Sherlock Holmes. In his early 20s, back when he was rooming with James Watson in a tiny flat in Edinburgh, Leander had socked away his inheritance in smart investments and lived like a church mouse. My uncle, despite his well-groomed appearance, had always been a frugal man. When his investments brought him returns, he bought property, and with the income from letting out those, he purchased new places, sold others, tailored his portfolio. All of this to say, we had some places to hide.
They're largely under my name, he'd said. The flats in New York and Edinburgh, the house in Provence, those are the ones I've kept.
We can't go there, then?
No, we can't. But London is another matter. I bought a flat there a few years ago, through a dummy corporation. I was on an undercover case. I needed a bolt hole for quick changes, a place to stash my things that couldn't be traced. I never did sell it. I worried that it might be useful again.
He gave me a grim smile.
And here we are.
Here we were. Goodbye to New York, I thought, stuffing my wigs back into their wooden box. Goodbye to Connecticut. Goodbye to America. Who knew when I'd have reason to be back here again? Goodbye to picking locks, prying doors with crowbars, to putting on doe-eyed masks to learn what I needed to know. I would help him research. I would help, and I would stay out of the way. My mother hadn't called me once since I'd left home. I thought again about the argument she and my father had had in Switzerland, where she pled my case to him for 5 minutes, and then, as far as I knew, never did again. Any love my mother had for me was bound up in the frustration she had with my father, and now, with him absent, it was as though I'd ceased to exist as well. There had been so many losses. My parents, August, Milo gone radio silent during that never-ending murder trial, and while I had always imagined Jamie Watson leaving me bit by bit, he'd instead done it all at once, pulled the bandage off while the wound was still bleeding. Had it been wild denial or self-destruction that had sent me running headlong into the jaws of the beast that was hunting me? Why, really, had I spent the last year chasing Lucy and Moriarty, except to put a speedier end to it all? I had diligently photographed my pills each night. I had eaten and bathed and traveled and plotted. I had pretended to be looking to the future, and all the while it looked like I was living. But the moment I knew I wouldn't kill Lucy and Moriarty was the moment I wrote my own ending. I saw that now. I didn't know another way to be rid of him, the spider that had built a web over the world. Chasing him down without a gun in hand would ultimately end with my death. I didn't want to die. Not anymore. My box of wigs, my lock-picking kit, my recording equipment, my dress blacks, my casual blacks, the makeup lockbox that held all my other faces, all of it into the suitcase. I put on a set of old sweats I'd found in the chest of drawers. They were too big on me, but I did them up anyway. I'd leave $50, more than enough to replace them. I had $3,000 to burn, more than enough for a plane ticket across the pond and a dye job when I got there. Enough to pay the fee to change my name, to make myself disappear. I hauled my suitcase into the kitchen, enjoying the sound of my footsteps on the tile. My boots looked ridiculous with the sweats, I was sure, but after weeks of walking silently, I needed to hear myself move.
I'm charging your laptop and the phones I found in your bag.
Leander was rummaging through the pantry, throwing dry goods in a pile. There was quite a lot of peanut butter.
Who lives here? I'll reimburse them for the food, but I want to have supplies in case we need to hole up before our flight. Ideally, we'd leave late tonight, but if we miss our window, I don't think it's safe to try until 3 or 4 weeks have passed.
Late tonight? I asked. It was barely 4 o'clock in the evening. Why not now? We can go straight to the airport, get the red-eye to London. Leander had his back to me. He spread his hands out on the counter.
I'm going to say goodbye to James Watson before I go, and you're going to come with me.
You're what?
God help me, Charlotte, don't argue with me on this.
No, I categorically refuse. That man cannot keep a secret to save his life, and the last thing I need is for him to see me when his son, I can't. My uncle bowed his head.
You can do this one last thing for me.
This last thing? Damn it, he said.
I am not leaving you alone in this flat with that man loose in this city.
I bit my lip. I'm sorry.
I know.
I watched him breathe out. If it's important to you...
You should probably change, he said. James called it a wedding reception.
I dragged myself back to the bedroom. At home, in Sussex, we dressed for dinner, but that was an exercise I'd never taken seriously. It was another disguise, one masquerading as the self. Long skirts my mother bought me, elegant and expensive, and dark lips to match their dark colors. Done up like that, I looked years older than I was. Here, I had nothing that didn't belong to Rose the fashion vlogger, and I didn't want to wear her right now. I flipped through D.I. Green's sister's closet, wondering idly if she'd have anything that would fit me. Cardigans, blouses with high necks and buttons on the cuffs, and then a row of cocktail dresses. Two were in my size, the second of those was red. I shed my clothes and put it on and walked over to the mirror. Watson had once described me as a knife. It's true that I have no curves. If we are speaking geometrically, I am a line. This dress didn't change the fact of my body, but then I didn't need it to. I took a pair of shoes from the closet and a silver evening bag from the hook on the closet door. I stuffed it with necessities. We would return for our suitcases if we could. If we couldn't, I would make do with what I had.
Charlotte,
Leander was saying, almost as though he were being strangled. I found him bent nearly double over a mobile phone on the kitchen counter. What happened? I asked, panting, and then I really got a look at him. No, you're not. You're laughing. Why do you have my old mobile? He'd said he was charging both of my phones. I'd been keeping the one I'd used at Sheringford at the bottom of my bag, turned off so the GPS couldn't be used to track my location. It was always a good idea to have a spare. It was almost always a good idea to have a spare.
It says... You haven't booted it up in 11 months, my uncle said,
wiping the tears from his eyes. 11 months! In that time, you received 0 messages, 0 texts, until today. Until, quite literally, just now. I snatched my phone from his hand. 4 new texts. Holmes. Holmes. Charlotte. Where are you?
19. Jamie. Last year, Sussex Downs. Charlotte Holmes put her hands to her face. She was crying.
Milo, she said. Milo, Milo, no. No, you didn't.
In the distance, a car started up. There was yelling, someone crying out, "Don't touch me! Don't touch me!" And then wheels on loose gravel. When I turned to look, a lone figure, a man, was standing in front of the Holmes' dark estate, like someone locked out of their home, or a drifter looking for a place to spend the night. Holmes' mother was gone. Hadrian and Philippa, where were they? Milo was shaking. He held the gun out in front of him.
Is August and Hadrian? God, Lottie, I can't do this anymore. Lucian disappeared. He disappeared. There's no footage, no intel, no... I can't keep doing this. How could I, and succeed?
The master of the universe asking us this question. Holmes wrenched the rifle from his hands. Without looking down, she stripped the gun of its clip and dropped it all on the ground.
Leander's done, she said. August is dead. Is this it for you too? Are you leaving the two of us here to pick up this mess?
It's your mess, Milo said. Isn't it time you did?
I was only half hearing it, what they were saying. In the distance, the ocean raged louder. The cold bit at my hands. August Moriarty was spread-eagled, and it wasn't a dream. I could see the outline of his coat in the snow. I couldn't look at them, either of them, Holmes or Holmes, two faces of the same terrible god staring out in opposite directions, passing their judgments, firing their guns. And the figure in front of the house, he was gone, the field empty now, and the ocean was deafening. But it wasn't the ocean. It was sirens, a cacophony of sirens, and by the time the red and blue lights reached the top of the drive, Holmes and I were alone. Milo had gone. One moment he was there, and the next there weren't even footprints, as though he'd erased himself where he stood. I looked for them, for a sign. There were animal prints, deer and fox, the low slide of a rabbit, a dog's muddy paws. Even in the winter, this was a place that breathed with life.
Watson,
Holmes was saying. The man lingering near the house was looking at us. He held up a hand and then pointed his finger, like a teacher calling on a student. Then he pulled his coat more firmly around himself and walked away from us toward the house.
Watson, Holmes said. Watson! Jamie! Look at me!
I wrenched my eyes toward her. I felt slow and heavy, as though someone were holding me down underwater. The up-down, up-down wail of the siren beat against us like a current. It was an ambulance. Someone must have called one. Was there a house close enough to hear the gunshot and call 999? I almost asked Holmes, but she was looking at me like I was a cancerous growth she needed to have removed.
What now?
I asked, half laughing.
What's the plan?
Her eyes were always colorless. Now they were cold.
I need you to take the fall,
she said, turning to look at the paramedics jumping out the back of the ambulance.
I need you to confess.
Had it been any other day, any other situation, I might have agreed. I might have flung myself into it after her. Maybe it was desperation for connection. Maybe it was delusion, folie à deux. Maybe for the last 3 months I'd had a death wish, throwing myself off bridges, not caring if any net hid at the bottom. Not this time.
That's what I'm here for, then, to take the blame. Watson, that's the big reason behind me coming along with you. I'm the fall guy, the person you pinned it on. You've had weeks, weeks, Holmes, to explain. If you'd said anything at all, anything,
I could have changed your mind, but you maneuvered me here just to...
She whirled on me.
This is love,
she snarled, her pupils pinned, her eyes all dangerous light.
This is what love looks like. Then no one's ever loved you, I said, including me.
The paramedics. I would get their attention. There was a police car right behind them, men pouring out of its doors, a detective, unmistakable in her plain clothes and sunglasses, a radio in her hand.
Hey,
I yelled.
Hey, I need help.
Watson, she said, grabbing my arm.
What are you doing?
Telling the truth. She didn't have an answer for that. I shook her off and ran to meet the approaching officers.
There was a man here. He's tall. He has glasses. He had a rifle with a scope. He shot our friend. He's still out here somewhere.
The officer looked past me, to August's cooling body.
Where?
He demanded.
Which way did he go?
I pointed helplessly at the copse of trees where he'd been hidden, hoping they'd find something I'd missed, something to point the way. The policeman took off at a run, the others behind him. Holmes stared after them, wild-eyed.
Wait,
she said.
Wait. Wait. I did it.
It was soft. So soft that only the officer at the back stopped and turned to see.
I did it,
she said again.
It was me.
Miss,
he said, a bit pleading.
I know that isn't true.
She stalked forward.
I used a .338 sniper rifle from the top of that elm. I've been practicing at the range in Eastbourne for years. Take my picture to them. They'll identify me. I've been away for the last 2 years.
The officer took an involuntary step back.
Back up,
he said into his radio.
Back up.
But I've been planning this all this time, because that man over there...
She jabbed a finger at August's body.
He broke my heart. He lied to me. He proposed to someone else. He belonged to me, and he proposed to Bryony Downs, and I will be damned if I see him go. If I saw him go. Past tense. We're past tense now.
The officer put his hands up, nodding, the way you would with a tiger in a center ring.
And this?
Holmes jerked her hand at me.
This pathetic, sniveling boy thinks that if he gets me out of this mess, he can have me like I'm some prize to be won. Look at it. Look at me. How much is it worth to you now?
D.I. Green,
the officer said gratefully, as the woman in the long coat approached, picking her way through the snow.
We have a confession. I haven't cautioned her. It's an excited utterance.
Her sharp eyes went from Holmes to me and back again.
Which one?
She asked.
Her.
Did I imagine it, the D.I.'s disappointment?
Fine, she said. Cuff her. Caution her, then ask her again. You too, boy, come along.
Cautiously, the officer took Holmes by the arm. Despite everything, despite the way she'd all but spit blood in his face, he treated her like she was spun glass. He put the cuffs on her wrists, and the D.I. put a hand on her shoulder, and the three of them walked back to the car. I made to follow them, and then I saw that I had missed the paramedics taking August's body away. From a distance, I saw them hoist the gurney up into the back of the ambulance. They would take him to the morgue. They would cut off his clothes and lay him on a slab, like an object, like a doll. I wondered who they'd call to identify him, who was left to come and say his name. Beyond him, the police were putting Holmes into the car. They were taking their time with it, like they were paying her a courtesy. I knew she had worked with the Yard before, in London. She'd helped some detective whose name I'd forgotten solve the case of the Jameson diamonds, the one that I'd heard about all the way in America. But we were far from London now, and America, too, and the police here would only know the Holmes name and not the girl who wore it. I hadn't realized until I registered the wet on my knees, but I had bent down to kneel in the snow. I didn't think I could walk. Time had gone slow. The police were milling around now, putting up tape, taking out a camera and tripod from the car to photograph the scene. It didn't matter. I would just stay here, in a place where I didn't have to think. Someone put a hand on my shoulder.
Come with me, boy,
he said, and I nodded and got up and followed. He led me around the house and to the cellar door, still open, the floor below it dirty and covered in straw.
"Down," he said.
I turned to look at him. It was Holmes's father, Alistair.
"Why?" I asked him. "They want you to wait down here," he said. "Come along."
He was kind about it, in practice. He gave me an arm to help me down the stairs, and once I was down there, he produced a chair, one from the dining room table, it looked like, from its high, carved back, and let me get myself settled before he pulled out the rope. I didn't remember what he did with it. I only remembered the after, the rope wrapped around me like a snake. Looking at me there, he steepled his fingers under his chin.
"I'm sorry to have to do this," he said.
There was something in his face that had been snuffed out.
"I'd much rather have my daughter here with you. I think it would give you some comfort to have her beside you. Do you want me to put out a chair for her, too, as a symbol?"
"No," I said. I had the vague sense that something was wrong. I wiggled a little against the rope, but it held.
"Oh," Alistair said, watching me. "You're coming out of shock. That'll make this harder."
Behind him, the wall was hung with weapons, a pair of fencing foils, a set of knives with the edges dulled. This was their practice room. I looked back at Alistair's face. His eye was bloodshot and bleeding from where I'd kicked him, crawling out of the cellar. I had the insane urge to apologize. It was insane, that urge, wasn't it? But so was being bound up to a chair in the cellar of a house where your friend had just been murdered.
"Will you let me go?" I asked him cautiously. "Do you have a compelling reason?" he asked. "I always made my children give me a compelling reason. Why do you think I've led you here? There are several pretty points to be made. Biblical, Isaac and Abraham. You could start with those."
"Okay," I said. "How about you're a right bastard?" But Alistair had already lifted up the gas container. That was when I started struggling in earnest.
"Help!" I yelled. "Somebody help me! I'm down here!" "Make no mistake," he said. "This wasn't my first choice of action, but it's the only logical one remaining. Lucian has no reason anymore to keep our financial situation a secret."
"Your financial situation," I said, gasping as he doused my legs in fuel. I hardly felt it. They had already been wet from the snow.
"What the hell does that mean?"
Now he was washing his own legs with the gasoline.
"It means I've been taking payouts from the Russians, convincing my friends at MI5 to be in certain places at certain times, leaking the information, letting them get picked off, like chickens in a little house waiting. There's a song about it, I think."
I was the architect of some small international conflicts, he'd told me on the day I'd met him. "I thought you worked for the Ministry of Defense."
"The MOD. I started there. I spent some time in Whitehall, too. Home Office. MI5. I came back. Where on earth do you think my daughter learned her skill set? She certainly didn't intuit her abilities. But it's over. Do you know how Lucian Moriarty escaped his surveillance in Thailand?"
I didn't say anything.
"No guesses? Pity. Do you know what my country does to traitors? Lucian Moriarty does. And when he found he couldn't control my actions, when he couldn't control my daughter's actions, he stopped mincing words. I would call in the last of my favors. I would go out there myself, have a word with Milo, a drink. I would wait until he slept, and then call on those men loyal to me and his company."
"You have spies? In Greystone?"
"Of course I do," he said impatiently. "Why on earth wouldn't I? It pained me to do it, of course, to help that man. He's a blunt instrument, much like my daughter. I'd always thought she'd come to an untidy end, but at Lucian's hands... Well, I suppose it's no use now. Lucian is on the loose, as ridiculous as that sounds. And no matter what promises he made me, I know he'll leak the information anyway. What loyalty does a man like that feel? None. It'll all come to light. The only real recourse I have is to erase the evidence. I, myself, am evidence. Your evidence as well. And Leander, of course, and my wife, though those two are beyond my reach. This is the best I can do. The insurance policy should leave a nice nest egg for my son, if he ever decides to settle down. From his pocket he pulled a lighter. Not a metal-plated one, as I'd expected. Something precious and small, but a plastic one, the kind you bought at the gas station.
No, I said. No, 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 absolutely not.
Or he could just buy himself another war, Alistair said, squinting at the small fire in his hands. I swear that boy has more influence than I'd ever dreamed of. I kicked my feet against the floor, skittering my chair back.